Well, good morning, everyone. We're so happy that you chose to join us for this session. I'd also like to welcome the online audience, some of who may be continuing with us from last session or some who may be new. We're currently live streaming to over 400 locations in the United States and internationally, so we're very happy to have all of you with us. Before introducing our speakers this morning, I would like to give you a couple of reminders. Number one, please silence your cell phones and electronic devices if you don't mind. Next, we are going to have questions and answers that will be asked of our panelists. If you are here on site in the room, we would ask you to please line up by the mics. There's one here in the middle part of the front room and one in the back, because the online audience will not be able to hear your question if you don't use the microphone. So please use the microphone. If you are online, I will be moderating your chat. So if you would please put speaker cue and then your question, I will be able to slip your questions to the moderator as well. And finally, we would like to encourage you each to complete the online evaluation for this session, preferably while you're still on site and can remember what happened. But the opportunity to evaluate does continue after the conference. A link to each session evaluation can be found in the session details page within the online website agenda. You can also find forms on the mobile app. And if you're participating online, you can find a link on each session page in the virtual conference center. So for right now, I will turn it over to your moderator, Jerry Grochow, who's going to take you on an adventure through cloud contracting.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. I'm Jerry Grochow with Internet 2, and I am joined here on the panel by three experts, three people who have been working with us and with your schools over the past almost 2 years at this point in the area of cloud contracting. And let me just quickly introduce our panelists. On my immediate left is Thomas Trappler, who's the Director of Software Licensing with UCLA. Next to him is Nancy Lynch, a Senior Counsel at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And next to Nancy is Alan Fischel, who is a partner with the law firm of Arendt Fox, who works with Internet 2. The topic this morning is one of a series of discussions about the Internet 2 Net Plus program, and in particular about cloud contracting. Let me first ask, at least of those of you in the audience, how many of you are familiar with the Internet 2 Net Plus program? Excellent, excellent. So let's move right into it. We all know that moving to the cloud is a new paradigm shift. We've seen many of these over the past decades as we've been in the IT field. But the question is, how is this shift, if you will, different from some of the others? We have been managing the technology for so long that that's what we're used to. We've built it. We've maintained it. That's what the technological world is all about. But now we're moving to an environment where it's contractually managed as much as anything else. Someone else has built it. Someone else is maintaining it. But how do we ensure that they're doing it right? And this is part of the set of issues that I think we're all dealing with in moving to the cloud. So the question is, how can we most effectively mitigate the risks associated with adopting cloud solutions so that we're getting the maximum benefits? And this morning, we're going to be focusing specifically on the issues of contracts. Contract negotiation, of course, is, you know, what do I get? Once we have the contract, we have to work with the vendors, we have to manage them to make sure that we continue to get it. And in fact, one of the other sessions that's going on later this afternoon is going to be talking about some of the issues of the kind of staff we need in the IT department to deal with both contract negotiation and vendor management. I would, however, point out a little caveat here, which is, at least in the legal sense, but often in the very practical sense, if it's not in the contract, don't expect to get it. And what we have right now in a lot of cloud services, particularly those where an individual faculty member or staff member is just doing a click-through agreement, is it's not in the contract. What we've been trying to do with the Net Plus program is make sure it is in the contract so that we can be sure as schools and users of these services that we are getting what we need from the point of view of higher ed. In the Net Plus program, as we all work together to work with these various cloud vendors, it's Internet 2 and the schools that are working with us that are taking on the burden of contracting for the cloud. We're working with the service providers, with university councils, with cloud experts from the universities to craft a business agreement, the agreement that is going to be between Internet 2 and the cloud services vendor. There are multiple different types of these business agreements. In particular, we found that there are situations where the university wants to contract directly with the cloud service vendor. In other situations, the cloud service vendor is contracting through Internet 2 to the university. And we can talk about some of those differences in the different types of contracts. We've recently added the ability for the regional networks in the U.S. and some of the national networks in other countries to also make these cloud services available, and that's required additional clauses and changes to these contracts to make sure that those are handled. But the key thing in all of this that we're doing is we're really leveraging the power of the community in order to negotiate the terms that we need. How many of you were in last night's constituency group related to licensing? Anybody in that session? A few of you. You heard the kinds of discussions that were going on where schools were saying, gee, I tried to negotiate this with the vendor, and the vendor was there saying, well, you know, we don't really do that, but if a lot of people need it, maybe we'll do it. Well, we are a lot of people. If we work together, through EDUCAUSE, through Internet 2, through other organizations, we can get the vendors to understand the kinds of clauses that we need in these contracts. And of course, in doing this, we're also reducing the administrative costs, we're reducing the time and effort that it takes for individual schools to be involved in a contract negotiation, because once the Internet 2 group with the group of schools that are part of what we call the service validation, which I'll get to in a second, have developed the contract, we now have a contract that everybody can sign. And if your council is not happy with something in the clause, we can give that person the name of half a dozen other councils at other schools who have been part of that negotiation to get that clause and hopefully understand why that clause is there, so that the councils at one school can begin to also rely on the councils at other schools that have been putting these contracts together. So the whole process of bringing a new service from initial discussions with a service provider to general availability of that service to our community is laid out here. But the crucial step is what we call service validation. And in service validation, there's going to be one school that sponsors the service provider and anywhere from 3 to 5 other schools that have signed up to work on either technical issues, business issues, functional issues, or legal issues with that service provider, so that when we come out of service validation and we start to make the service more broadly available, there is a signed contract, there is a set of signed documents, actually, that are appropriate for this service. This is all about sponsorship by Internet 2 member schools, subscription by members and non-members, either directly through Internet 2 or through their regional and global networks, and with services that have been now modified, with contracts that have been modified, that are now specific to the needs of the higher ed community. That's what this is all about. It's an approach to contracting that really funnels together the inputs of university councils and other cloud experts, the Internet 2 staff and council, and the service provider to get to these various agreements that I mentioned. The business agreement that is between Internet 2 and the service provider, the enterprise customer agreement that is what the school is going to sign, and then whether there are service terms of use that may need to be signed by faculty and staff and students who are using the service. All of these documents have to come out of this process. We have now developed template contracts as a result of doing this about 24 times with some 50 or 60 schools that have participated. We've got a pretty good understanding of the kinds of issues that both the vendors are concerned about and the schools are concerned about. Each time we go through this process, we're looking for ways to improve those templates so the next time is easier and easier. And to head off one question, yes, we will publish these templates. So those of you who want to use other cloud services that maybe are not part of the Internet 2 Net Plus program can also use these templates as starting points as you go forward. So what are some of the key issues that we're seeing and that need to be addressed? And Thomas, Nancy, and Alan are going to be talking about this in more detail. At the very beginning, there are issues of what is the service? What is the definition? What is the service level agreement? Does the vendor comply with the various laws and regulations that we're required in the university environment to deal with? Not just FERPA, but also HIPAA, HITECH, others, state provisions that are often necessary and perhaps in conflict. We have to deal with all of those in this contracting process. A big one that comes up all the time has to do with data. And there are many aspects of this, starting with who owns the data. I was just in a session with our colleagues from medical schools, and they're very concerned about ownership of data. And someone was saying, well, in cloud services contracts, they don't say anything about ownership of data. Well, guess what? In the cloud contracts that we're negotiating together, we do say something about ownership. We talk about where the data is going to be located, whether it needs to stay within the U.S. or not, various privacy issues, and certainly a long list of security issues. Now, flowing out of this, of course, there are then a variety of questions about liability. What if there are data breaches? What if various terms of the contract are not complied with? And that's always a negotiation. Sometimes university councils start off the position and say, well, we can accept absolutely zero liability, and the vendor has to have unlimited liability. Well, we're also trying to be practical here, and we're trying to get these contracts actually signed, and there's no vendor that is going to accept completely unlimited liability. In fact, I think you would question the viability of a vendor that has a lot of contracts that give them unlimited liability. So we're working these kinds of things through, but these are clearly the issues that come up. Of course, on the business side, pricing, what is the type of agreement? Is this a campus-wide license and so on? What's the term? Are there pricing escalation or de-escalation? We much prefer the de-escalation that we can put into the contract. And then we also have to recognize that contracts end, whether they end normally or they end abnormally because of non-performance. And there are concerns about, well, if there's data out in the cloud, how do we get that? What do we do for ongoing services and so on? So there's a long list of areas here where there have been a number of issues. Some of these negotiations, as Nancy and Alan and Tom can tell you, have gone on for months. But once they're gone through with a particular vendor, we then have that contract, and everyone signing up can use that contract without having to negotiate further. So this is the overall approach. This is what we're doing. This certainly, in order to be successful in the cloud, the contract can't solve everything, and you have to have ongoing vendor management. On the Internet 2 side, we have program managers who are working with the vendors, but also from the universities. And there was just a couple of sessions that I'm sure some of you were in where people were talking about what that means. How do you have a vendor management on your side? What kinds of people do you need? And so on. We certainly also need to worry about change. Vendors are changing their software every week. We need to think about, you know, how license terms need to change over time. We're already on second and third versions of licenses with some of the vendors. And again, you can do some of this within the university, but as a community, we want to make sure that we do this with help from everybody, from your peers, from EDUCAUSE, and from Internet too. So what I want to do now is turn it over to our panelists, who are each going to talk on different aspects of this. And let's begin with Thomas Trapper.
Thank you, Jerry. And good morning, everyone, and thanks for coming today. Now, when you think about cloud computing, you're thinking about the different variations, right? Software as a service, infrastructure as a service, platform as a service, right? What's the key thing in common here? Service, right? What we're acquiring when we acquire a cloud computing service is an intangible functionality and end result. The primary place that is instantiated is in the contract. So this is why it's essential that our contracts include service level agreements that describe the parameters of the service that are most important to us. Now, these will vary on a case-by-case basis, depending upon some key factors such as what sort of data we're putting out in the cloud and how sensitive it is, and the business criticality of the function we're putting out in the cloud. So in one case, availability may be the most important element of the service to us, or one of the top. Another case is performance or response time. Perhaps support or error correction might be important to us. So some of the key elements when we include a service level agreement in the contract might be, or almost always include, metrics. How is that particular service and the vendor's performance against that service level agreement measured? And what is the minimum performance against that service level that the vendor must meet? We need to come up with SLA metrics that are as quantitative and unambiguous as possible so that there's no questions, that both sides are on the same page with that performance against the SLA. We want to think about data sources and data fields, collection times and frequency, and ultimately who's responsible for collecting that data and reporting it back. We want to make sure that these SLAs and the metrics that we tie to them are associated and related to a business outcome, right? What are we trying to achieve with this particular cloud service, as opposed to just a purely a technical parameter, right? So another element we want to think about is we can have the greatest SLA in the world, we can have the right minimums, the right metrics, et cetera, but if we don't include any remedies, so the vendor has not met its minimum performance against this SLA, the SLA is not worth the paper it's written on. Right? We have to have some clause in there, some language in there that's saying, if you don't meet this SLA to a particular vendor, what will happen? It's usually one of two things. Either there will be some form of corrective action, in which case, you know, what will you do to make sure you don't miss the remedy again? But more commonly, you'll see something akin to a penalty. And these usually most commonly take the form of some sort of financial penalty, some credit that will come back to us, the client, for each missed SLA. For example, you can look at the Internet to Net Plus box agreement. It has a table in there of certain percentages of availability, and when the vendor doesn't meet certain tiers, certain credits will come back to the client. And it's a very solid SLA because you'll see somewhere, if I don't meet 90%, you know, you get 20% credit, and that's it. So it could be zero, and you're still paying. Under the box agreement, once it drops below 99%, essentially you don't pay anything, so the full credit comes back. But it's important to remind, a lot of folks kind of go crazy on remedies and financial remedies. What we're trying to do is come up with a remedy that motivates the vendor to perform and meet the SLA to begin with. What we want to stay focused on is we want to know that we have the service at the level that we expect. We don't really want to collect on the penalties or remedies at all. One other element just to think about, people can get really wrapped up in SLAs, thinking about every last element of the service. I usually recommend, you know, keep it to something around 8 SLAs maximum. This accomplishes two things on the vendor management side, as Jerry was mentioning. It's on us, the client, to manage the vendor's performance against those SLAs. Once you go beyond 8 to 10, it really can become unmanageable. And it also accomplishes the goal of keeping the vendor focused on the top aspects of the parameters of the performance, you know, that are most important to us. So just kind of a high-level overview of some SLA issues, and I will hand off to Alan.
Tom. Can everyone hear me? Yes. Well, it's a pleasure to be here today. As Jerry mentioned, I've been doing work from my law firm of Aaron Fox, where I'm a partner for several years, for a number of years for Internet 2. And I've had the honor and the privilege to work with people like Tom, Nancy, and so many great university counsel. I went to the session last night, and I've heard so much from universities over the years. And my impression is that there's three really important aspects of agreements. And sometimes there's more focus on the first two and a little less on the third. Sometimes what I'll hear is the following. We absolutely have to get a good product slash service. We absolutely have to get a good price. And by the way, we need to make sure there's, you know, there's the legalese and the lawyers will take care of it, you know, whatever that legalese may be. And the key thing here is you don't want great, great, fair, great, great, poor. You want great, great, great. You want to make sure that, quote, unquote, the legalese doesn't come back to bite you. So you ended up negotiating, getting that exact product you wanted, the exact product you want, and the knock on the door comes a year later. This provider changed the product. They changed it in a lot of different ways, and they've made these changes. And you go, well, at least, you know, they can't do that, right? The agreement doesn't permit that. No, actually it does. Well, the good news is at least we could terminate if they do that, or at least we can move a different direction. No, actually we can't. Actually, we're going to be paying throughout the entire term of the agreement. What protections does the agreement give us? On that point, actually gives us none. Okay, so that's your provider form agreement. That's where Internet 2 gets involved in multiple ways with the universities. They make sure that's not going to be the scenario. They have a roadmap group where universities get to actually have input with providers with respect to what they're going to do. But at the end of the day, and providers try this all the time, at the end of the day, if we don't get the service we want, if it changes in a way we're not expecting, then the universities need at least, at the very least, because most providers are going to insist that they have to change their service when they have to change it, we at least have a way out. So you're not caught in that position. It's an example of where the legalese is really critical to what you're looking at. Let me throw in a couple other examples for you. So the provider, and this goes a little bit to what Tom's talking about with SLAs, the provider agrees to indemnify you for infringement. Great. You look at the clause, absolutely there. They're indemnifying you for infringement. That's the good news. Bad news? They're actually not indemnifying you for much money. If it goes above a little limited amount, actually you'll pay the rest. So you're looking at one provision looks great, another provision takes away most of what you thought you had. What Internet 2, with these people and others, work through is to make sure that you don't get caught in that trap. Another example is you get a call that says, oh my goodness, the provider just suspended the service. You're saying, for what? Well, actually turns out we're a day late in payments. Well, we didn't know it. Or it turns out the provider thought, you know, one user was misusing the service and wanted to do it. These are things you need to make sure are covered in your agreement. And the best way to do that is through working and having the leverage that Jerry's talking about, getting what we need there to make sure they don't have a quick way to suspend, a quick way to terminate. One of the issues that comes up the most that I hear in every agreement we do, I can't think of one that I haven't heard it with, is, listen, Alan, you, your universities, need to be responsible for anything the students do. You're on the hook for that. And, you know, employees, you know, corporations are on the hook for their employees do. You have to be on the hook for what your students do. We push back really hard. We end up not being on the hook for that. But I have to tell you, the number one argument providers make on that point is the following. Every university I've ever dealt with has agreed to this. I hear it over and over and over again. I've talked to a lot of university counsel who often tell me, yeah, I've agreed to it in agreements because I've absolutely had no choice. I've been told we're signing this either way, no matter what, and I've had no choice. Do I like it? No, we didn't have the leverage. We've now got the leverage. It changes the dynamic. Now, when I say to a provider we're not willing to agree to that, of course they don't turn around and say, oh, sounds good. You know, what's the next clause? They push, they fight. We work through it. So the way the process works with Internet 2 is the following. We start, as Jerry pointed out, with our form agreement. It gets us off to an advantage right there because we're using our form rather than their form. They're willing to agree to that because they're looking at the potential for all these universities at once. A university could say, here's our form, and often they could say, that's interesting, but we're not looking at it. So we start with our form. We know our form inside and out. People kid me that I have it in my back pocket. You can check. Totally false. Never keep it in the back pocket, ever. But it would fall out, for one thing. But certainly we know our agreement inside and out. you know, I've been negotiating agreements for many, many years. In fact, the American Association of Corporate Counsels has allowed me and my law firm to put to be the exclusive content provider with respect to the negotiations portal on the ACC site that opened last week. So I've seen it all. I've negotiated against the best attorneys, the weakest attorneys, the ones who never stop talking, the ones who are great and know they're great, the ones who are not so great and think they're great. So you deal with every type of negotiator. So we go through all of that, we work it through, and the goal is we push back, and then we get university counsel involved. And to get people as strong as the university counsel involved is a tremendous advantage. We strategically utilize university counsel by having our own phone calls with them, by getting them on with the provider when the time is right. You know, when we think, you know, the provider's saying, hey, Alan, I've heard it from you a lot of times. I haven't heard it from the universities. We're already ready to then have the universities get on the call with them to find a way to get there. And I want to be clear, and I want to go back to something Jerry said, because, you know, maybe – hopefully this wouldn't be surprising coming from an attorney, but, you know, this is the way we practice. Near the end of our process, this isn't something where we're trying to get an agreement where it's the exact opposite of what the providers provide you. The provider's form agreement is usually, not always, usually on a scale of 1 to 10, anywhere from a 1 to a 3, depending on the provider. We are not trying to get a 10 where everything is completely in our favor and everything's against them. We are trying to get a strong agreement that protects the universities in which we're fair. And what always happens, because Internet 2 and the university community is extremely intellectually honest, is near the end of the process, there are always provisions the providers have messed up on. We know what they've negotiated, we've agreed to it, and they end up drafting it wrong, they end up not seeing what's in our customer agreement, and yes, we will tell them. We will not take advantage of them. We're not looking to absolutely in any way take advantage of. We're looking to not be taken advantage of. We're looking for, going back to what I said at the beginning, that you have a great situation with both the product, the service, and the agreement, because any of those can burn you. So here's what's going on. Providers often aren't just trying to be aggressive. Often they don't know your business. They don't know exactly how your industry works, and they've had tremendous success throwing their form at you. So we'll get a provider that would say something to me like, listen, you know, we have a terms of service that we think works really well. And let me tell you, Alan, we have taken your university's thoughts. You know, we haven't spoken to you yet. We've taken your thoughts in consideration. We've tailored this to universities. And I'm saying it doesn't look like it. I see like 15 to 20 things they may have a concern about. Alan, you might not have noticed on page 1 it uses the word university 3 times. It uses students twice. It's absolutely tailored for you guys. So we have to work through that with them, explain that's not the kind of tailoring we're looking for. We're actually looking for tailored provisions that get us there. But the bottom line overall is we end up getting there with these providers through, as Jerry pointed out, knowing what they need, knowing what we need, and then really working through it over time. It's not easy, but it is, and I would tell you this, from what I've seen over the years, it is transformative. It's really moving us in a tremendous direction that we didn't have before. Let me turn it over now to Nancy.
Thanks, Alan. I actually get to usher you in to say good afternoon. It is now afternoon, no longer morning. And I know many of your stomachs are probably curious about what's for lunch, but we will be short for you. So I wanted to, I echo many of the comments that have already been made by my colleagues, but I wanted to provide you a little bit of my own sort of personal experience as a lawyer for a large state Research One university, and why is it that I continue to donate my time to work with Alan and a variety of other folks. The reason is why is because I'm looking at all of you. This is why we do, why we're involved in this project. I've negotiated a great number of agreements with companies, and I would have these same experiences where I would have to tell each one of them and explain FERPA to them every single time, or I'd have to explain export control, or I'd have to explain HIPAA or high tech. All of those things, you would go through the same process. It's very tiring for us, and it's very tiring for them. And then when I realized that my colleagues at other institutions were having these exact same conversations, we wanted to be able to get together and try to do different things to achieve what NetPlus is achieving, but we ourselves couldn't do that. You could certainly do it with certain consortia that you're part of, but it isn't necessarily the same option that NetPlus is offering us in this particular situation. And I also was one of the individuals that would hear from these companies, oh, well, so-and-so university agreed to those terms. You have no idea how many times I wanted to call counsel at those institutions and say, what were you thinking when you agreed to these terms? But we keep it collegial in our unit. But I think with that pushback and from these companies and having to the ability to jump at the chance to work on these, what I wanted to share is that NetPlus has really done a big service for all of us. And it isn't just with that particular company that we're working with at that particular time. What it's doing is signaling to other companies that this is sort of the wave of the future, and this is where we've taken the bull by the horns, and we're deciding that we are going to do this in a fashion that helps institutions, as opposed to letting sort of the institutions be sort of drugged behind and let them sort of be at the whim of whatever company you're trying to work with. That is no longer the case, and we're not going to do that. And NetPlus is really one of those great options for us to be more positive in our approach and to get the terms that all of us know that we need. This isn't an issue of want. This is an issue of all of us being regulated, all of us having to be audited with different expectations from the federal government, various provisions, but also for individual state universities. Even we have very specific requirements that we have to meet as well. I'm a place that I can't offer someone indemnification. I could never indemnify another institution. So that is where we work really hard to get these provisions that are sort of that match what everybody needs, not just, you know, whether you're private or a public. I wanted to point out one other thing, though, that even though we get to this point of getting these contracts in place, for many of our institutions, that process does not end there. I was part of the BOX team. I'm part of another team right now, and I've done a couple other works with Internet 2 on contracts. But having completed the BOX, we were all thrilled and ready to pop the champagne. But my poor institution couldn't sign it until about a year later because we have our own internal processes and issues. I had to get a waiver, and we finally got that like 9 months later. So it isn't the solution to everything, but NetPlus has really taken off the table much of the consternation that we have in trying to get some of these particular provisions. So it's a positive, and it's been a good experience. And I want you to feel assured that the folks who are working, the lawyers that they bring in to work on this, and not just the lawyers, the technical people, because there are different groups of people who are involved in all of this. And at some point in time, there's a group that sort of pulls all of those together and gets the information, because we have to work with the technical folks too to make sure that what we want in an agreement can actually be done. And they want to make sure that what they're promising, we can actually draft language that makes sense. But the folks that are there because they're not there. We're not getting paid. We're not getting anything. We're there because we care about our institutions, and we want to make sure that the best provisions that we can get are done and made in a positive way. And that will lead to additional companies being brought in and wanting to work in this NetPlus environment. So I appreciate it. And I think at this point, Jerry, I think we're up open for questions, correct?
Right. Thank you very much. And those were all, I think, you know, really terrific points. We are a community, and we've had many opportunities to work as individuals within that community. This is an opportunity to work together and to really use the power of our community, which I think is what you've heard from several of our panelists. Let me see if there are any questions either here in the audience or from the far-flung field where this is being webcast. We're happy to entertain those now and for as long as people want to talk. And there's a microphone here and a microphone in the back. And please tell us.
See if there are. This is Tom Mayer from Georgia State University. One of the problems that we've experienced is the vendors aren't really clear yet about the cloud services world, because it's evolving so quickly. They're not really sure of the services that they're providing and how to contract for them. How is that being handled in these negotiations?
A good question. Who wants to tackle that one first?
Sure. I think it's getting easier over time. I noticed that even more 2 years ago. I think what's ending up happening is, you know, Jerry talked about, let me say it this way. I think a lot of what's going on refers to what we call Section 8 of our agreement, which is the data section. I think a lot of the uncertainty is there. And so what we end up doing is they'll say, well, you know, one of two things, right? Hey, we may not be able to agree to a standard provision you have there because we're not sure we can comply with it yet. We'll make some good faith efforts. We'll put in some language about we'll get there within the next year. Or, and I'll never say names, or they may call you after the fact and say, hey, we made a misrepresentation in our agreement. We're in a little bit of trouble now. Can you work with us? So in Section 8, where we have the data issues, I think they're getting smarter and smarter. I still think there are some issues there with respect to that because of the uncertainty. I think the other place I see it come up a little bit is where some of the vendors try to do a little bit more of limiting their liability because they're, I think your question is a very, very good one, because they're frankly a little worried that they may have a major breach that could lead them to bankruptcy if they do a deal with, you know, that it's just unlimited exposure. So it varies how the providers look at that. But we push back really hard because, you know, the story I was giving earlier, we don't want to say the good news is we have an indemnification provision. The bad news is it covers this tiny amount and nothing more than that. So I think we're able to convince the vendors at the end of the day it is your responsibility. You're going to have to take some risks. You know, you've gotten into this business. We understand that not every standard is in place. But more and more, and Tom, I know you know, more and more standards are coming in place. And we're expecting a lot out of you there. I think it's getting easier. I still think it's there to a degree. And I think it's an excellent question.
I want to add that's where us working with the technical teams actually is very helpful. They actually go out and test these different types of products or what we're working on. And they get feedback to us about here's where they need to shore up. Here's where it doesn't meet our expectations. And that helps us inform the vendor as well, and they can meet some of those, learn more about their own product. It's very much a collaborative environment in that regard, and then it helps feed us in terms of what language we need to really, that will really capture some of the concerns and how to address them.
And Nancy, that's a great point, because when we work with them, one of the comments I got just last week from a provider was, hey, your technical people have already approved what we're doing. And I'm like, that's good. That's a great start. Now let's see if what you've edited in Section 8 is consistent with what you told them on the calls we weren't on. And once you finally put it that way, they're fine with actually having, because, you know, it's great that they make these oral statements to the technical people and they're comfortable with them. We now have to make sure those oral statements match up with their edits.
I would just add, great question, because the cloud continues to evolve, right, as we speak. And there are vendors and providers coming into the cloud from many different worlds, a lot of them coming in from a traditional software licensing world, right? I've seen a lot of vendors come in and say, okay, now we're a cloud vendor, and here's our contract. And you take a look at it, and you're like, this is a software license agreement. This is not a cloud contract. And so it's an educational process from us to the vendors as well, not only in terms of, you know, what is entailed, what's different from their traditional world of software licensing or wherever it is to cloud contracts, but what are the unique needs in our world of higher ed?
And I think this is another important point. You know, we do take the educational mission very seriously, and that means educating ourselves and all of the universities collectively, but also educating the vendors. Educating the vendors about moving to the cloud, educating the vendors about what it means to deal with higher ed. So that's all part and parcel of this process. Another question.
Yeah, hi, Bob Flynn, Indiana University. I want to turn the equation around a little bit, and what can you recommend, or Jerry, for NetPlus, what can you do? It's usually IT bringing these things to the table. What can you do to help the university side to get everybody in to their comfort level, whether it's internal audit, the risk management folks, the university council, the HIPAA compliance officer, all of those? How can we standardize the information we provide to them to get them comfortable with us even opening these conversations?
Bob, I'm smiling a little bit because, as you know, I saw you standing outside the session where that was just discussed an hour ago, because it was a standing room only session, in talking about the fact that while we're talking about contracting here, that this is a process that involves many other parts of the university. And Bob mentioned some of them: procurement, internal audit, accounting. Everyone has to be educated about the cloud. And this is something that, while from the point of view of software licensing and university council, there's some very specific knowledge, this really is a campus-wide effort to move to the cloud. So regardless of what area you're in, you do have to think about how this goes across all those different areas. As to how to do that, well, you know, a lot of talking. Tom, you want to add?
I would also add, it is important, I think, to kind of bring together a team of those key roles so that there is this dialogue going on, because every one of those folks is going to see their own piece of this thing called the cloud. It's kind of that blind man and the elephant story of, you know, one folk's going to see the leg and think it's a tree and that sort of thing. Where was I going with that? So keeping that dialogue going on, but you know, educating folks around how the cloud is different and what it means, right, in terms of being different, how to address it in its unique aspect, right? We're not buying software. It's not like we're running it ourselves anymore. You know, getting an understanding of its unique, intangible nature. Starting to understand the importance of vendor management, right? As we're very good at kind of getting to the point of, okay, maybe we came to an agreement and we signed the agreement, we, you know, cut the PO, whatever it is. But understanding that that's when the hard work really begins, because now we're into this world where we have to manage the relationship with that vendor on an ongoing basis. And one anecdotal thing I would mention, I've heard this from others, but I've seen it as well, to remind folks that if you're contemplating a Net Plus agreement, is to remind particularly your procurement folks that Internet 2 is not the vendor, Internet 2 is us. And that's a very hard mind shift for these folks to wrap their head around, right? Because it's, I'm cutting a PO to them. They must be the adversary. What are they you know, asking for? Why aren't they changing things, right? Well, that's because they put it in the agreement what we wanted to begin with.
I think going to a point Jerry made at the beginning with the university council, and I think some of this could relate to the other groups as well, working together to come up with a standardized form. So I'll give you an example. FERPA. We worked really hard with so many university councils to come up with some FERPA language. And I got a call 6 months ago from a university council who said, hey, I think this FERPA language is really weak. I don't like it. I don't think it's great. And I said what you would say in that position. 30 others really like it, but we're really open to your thoughts. What do you mean 30 others? I said, well, 30 others have approved. And in fact, a lot of them helped draft it. But listen, if you can make it better, this is an open situation. We're always happy to make it better. We'd love to make it better. He calls me the next day and goes, I've reread it. It's actually great. So now you don't know, you know, so I'll say no more. I'll leave it at that. So it's really a, you know, a great collaborative.
And that gets to one other point about this whole process again. How many of you have signed agreements with vendors where there's a non-disclosure provision? Anybody? Okay. I did when I was at MIT. And I wanted to call those guys down the block and say, well, wait a minute, you know, what kind of deal did you get? What clauses did you get? And I said, well, we can't tell you. We signed a non-disclosure agreement. Now, we have ways of, you know, talking to each other informally and so on. But one of the things about this whole process with Internet 2 and Net Plus is openness. You know, we are all getting the same terms. We are all benefiting together. We are all getting the same pricing. We're benefiting as we use more and more of the services because the prices goes down for everybody. And as long as we're willing to stick together on this, we can do very well as a community. When we have that person who raises their hand and says, well, you know, nudge, nudge, I can get a better deal off to the side, the first question is, can they? And the second is, if they can, how do we all benefit from that? And this whole idea of open contracts within our community is an important thing. We have a question from the webinar, webcast. Contract provisions reflect risk tolerance. So how has Net Plus grappled with there being a common risk appetite? Some schools have more of a risk appetite than others. It's great to raise the bar, but are you finding examples of lowering the bar?
I can actually respond a little bit about that. The group of lawyers that I've worked with that's worked primarily with Alan, we vary in our risk tolerance. I have a really high level of risk tolerance. Some of my colleagues have a really low level of risk tolerance. So the arm wrestling is being done amongst us. And I think we try to find happy mediums, but what we generally go with is we look at what the risk is. I mean, if you're really dealing with a particular provision that's pretty low level, it's not really going to happen, you'll find that we are being much more appropriate and lenient in certain areas. If it's something that, but if it's something that's really important to us, all of us sort of shift in that direction. That it don't. This is a non-negotiable component. FERPA is a very good example of that. No institution is going to, nor can it, put in a provision that does not perfectly match what we are required to do. So that is where, that's one where we have a very low level of risk tolerance, and we're not going to negotiate very, we're not going to negotiate on those terms that much. So.
And I think that hits it right on the head. But I think the one thing I've seen is there's a couple things going on. We tend to err towards the ones with the higher level risk tolerance for sure, but we don't take it to the extreme. The other advantage we have is having dealt with so many universities. If we're talking to three universities and getting their thoughts about a provision, we may already know what 40 others thought when another provider tried the same provision. So we're really trying to take all of that into account and saying, okay, so we've got about 45 universities, 42 to 43 of which are fine going to this level. There may be one or two that would like to take that to another level, and maybe 20 of the first 43 would be even willing to go to a lesser level. We'll probably go with where the 43 are, not try to make it the ultimate extreme, and that's where we end up.
And that is, again, another aspect of this whole program. I think we recognize within higher ed we cannot satisfy 100% of the needs, desires of 100% of the universities in our community. But if we can get into the 90s on both of those, we're doing pretty well. And for those people who still believe they have very unique requirements, they can certainly try on their own, at their own expense, to deal directly with the vendors. We've been doing that for years. We know where that has led. In some cases, okay. In some cases, not okay. But certainly it's, you know, pretty expensive to do that. So now let's try something where we're all working together on this. We have another question. Let me then take a chance to wrap up here. First of all, let me ask the panelists if anyone wants to add any closing thoughts.
I think the one thing I want to make sure everybody's left with the impression is, yeah, we have a lot more leverage than we had before, but it's not a matter of just pounding the table and saying you must agree to it. We spend a lot of time persuading the providers, a lot of time explaining to them why their risk isn't as great as they think it's going to be. And remember I said to you earlier in this that a lot of times providers just say, well, every university's agreed to this. We now turn that around. You know, actually, every provider's agreed to this. And really just turning that around starts to give them a comfort level, going through the reasoning and the logic. So there's way more to it than pounding the table. There's a lot of reasoning, a lot of persuasion that goes on. And we utilize what's worked with other providers on the next group of providers. And so that's part of this process that it's – and last thing I'll say is, you know, the Providers Council varies greatly in terms of the level of ability and skill. The University Council I've dealt with varies a lot less. I just work with excellent University Council over and over again, including these two and so many others, and it's just a pleasure to work with this industry.
I would also just mention, echoing on Jerry's last comment, someone thinking, well, why shouldn't I just go off and do this on my own? You know, I'm a big university. I've got a lot of leverage. I would turn it around and say, really, why would you? The work's already been done. The effort's been done. I would think twice before going in on your own to see, do you really have such a unique need relative to what's been contemplated in these lengthy negotiation processes that have already happened?
That said, we are not infallible. So if you see things in these agreements or contracts that you think could be improved upon, that's something we always welcome. And we all do our very, very best, but there's always things that change and things that we can improve upon.
Absolutely. The documents, the NetPlus contracts are living, breathing documents. They go through multiple revisions, and those revisions come from the collective experience of the universities that are working together to do this. Let me just close with a couple of thoughts about, you know, what do you do in moving to the cloud? And this is a set of steps that any of you that have seen NetPlus discussions before have seen before, in terms of having a strategy that talks about both internal and external cloud services and where that fits in with other kinds of services you're doing. Working with all the other teams across the university, legal, procurement, other key stakeholders, making sure that policies and processes are not just changing a word or two from buying software or hardware, but really take account of how cloud services are different. Many schools are even developing positions within their organizations to focus on cloud product management, and that gets to kind of the general issue of how do you make sure that you have the right staff who can deal with vendor management, contract management, and other kinds of things. And of course, moving to the cloud is also, I think, about dealing with identity issues, and we have been using all the great work done by In Common over the years to do that. It's also not a sort of, you know, we've selected someone. This is about having a competition for services, but perhaps not wide open competition, but having enough service vendors in different categories that there is a group of choices that people can have. Certainly, we all hope, because it will benefit all of us, that your schools will continue to look to the Net Plus program. You started it, and it depends on all of us together bringing this forward. I want to thank our panelists for being here, Tom, Nancy, and Alan. Thank all of you for joining us as well. If you have any more questions, feel free to come up. We'll be staying around for a while after the discussion. Thank you very much.